Welcome to the Admin Happen Podcast, a podcast for people working in the real world of IT. If you're a sysadmin working on a help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, a computer tech who wants to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Andy.
And I'm Jerry.
And this is episode 100111, or 39 to everybody else. I know 39 is actually a song by three different songs. There's one called song called 39 by The Cure. There's a song called 39 by Tenacious D, and there's a song called 39 by Queen. It's on the Night of the Opera album. And also 39 is internet slang in Japan for saying the word thank you. Apparently, 3 means san and 9 means kaiyu or something like that. Of course, there's a famous Pier 39 in San Francisco. And if you want to call Italy on the phone, you have to dial 39 as the international calling number. And also as well, you know when you go 10-pin bowling and you're throwing the ball down there, do you know there's 39 slots of wood that makes up the bowling alley? So that's a good one for the next pub quiz you're in. So this is episode 39. What's everyone been up to?
Yeah, well, funny enough, I had to replace a disc in RAID 10 today, which is weird. We've been talking about RAID the last couple of weeks. And
did you refer back to last week's podcast?
Yeah. I was trying to find, I've been trying to find a document which kind of tells you what the RAID performance is, why you would choose different things, and still can't really understand what the difference are and what when you would use them to something else. Because I was reading about a bit before the show about things like it depends. If you're reading things like RAID 10 and RAID 50, is depending what sort of writes you're doing. So, like, is it sequential writes or random writes or reads? Because if it's like a database, it's meant to be better for one thing. I'm going to look into what sequential reads and writes are and randoms, and I'll come back next week.
I mean, it's about how you write data to the disk. So, with a database, your application that's talking to the database is likely to be going to random bits of the data on the disk, whereas the workloads my previous employer was processing data, so you'd get a long bit of data and you would have to read that whole lot of data in, do the processing, and then write it all out again. So I think that's, in a nutshell, that's what it is really. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'll let you do the research and do it for future podcasts.
Yeah, because I would have said, I had in my head that databases were sequential reads, but I was thinking about it, it's probably not, because it's just randomly writing data, isn't it? Or people are reporting, if you're pulling a query out, it's randomly picking data from the whole disk, isn't it, for seeking it. Yeah. Where if it's like you're doing some video or processing, you're kind of writing one bit after the other, you know, big go, aren't you?
So. Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Because I was just looking that, like, with RAID 1, it's got a high read performance, but it's got a write performance of a medium. And whereas, like, RAID 5 has got a high read speed, but a low performance, because obviously to write it, you've got to write it at two places, haven't you, before it confirms it's...
Well, RAID 5, you've got to write the parity, haven't you?
Yeah. So
you've got to calculate the parity and then write it, yeah.
Yeah. Whereas, like, RAID 10... compared to RAID 1, we were talking about last week, is that RAID 1 has got a high read performance, but RAID 1's got a medium write performance. But RAID 10's got both high read and high write performance, because of there's more disks to shed the load, isn't it?
Yeah.
Kind of thing. So I found this nice diagram, like a nice... graph or a thing that tells you what you'd use it for. So for like RAID 1, it's saying you want to use for your operating system and transaction databases, And then for RAID 10, you want it for fast database application servers. So, yeah, it's all quite interesting stuff. I really want to get my head around it. So I'll keep people in a form kind of thing. So
the RAID series will continue on another podcast.
So how have you been, Jerry?
I've been getting on with a few things. Most recently, I went to Ansible Fest, which is a conference put on by Ansible, the company, and I guess Red Hat now, since they bought them a few months back. It was just it was kind of a conference where people talked about Ansible and how they use it and news that's going on in the Ansible community. And one of the announcements there was that they put in a load of stuff for talking to network OSs like Cisco iOS and Juniper Junos. Now, I haven't used these particularly. I was working with HP switches in my old job. It's interesting that they're trying to move into this space, really. I've gone on about Ansible in the past and how useful I found it. It's just using it in that capacity as a network administrator seems like it could be good. But I guess we'll have to wait and see.
Was it all about OpenFlow by any chance?
I think there was something. I've got I'll put URL in the show notes. OpenSwitch it talks about.
Yeah, because there's a lot of this now software switch as a service. So basically, like people like Power, Facebook, or whatever.
Yeah.
And even things like Azure, they have it where you have a switch and you want to do a lot more with it. It's all software driven.
Yeah, software-defined networking.
Yeah, SDN. Yeah. That's what I was looking for. So. Yeah.
But, I mean, no, this is more about just configuring the switches. One of the guys that was telling us about it said was a lot of network engineers will dump out the configuration and put it in the Excel spreadsheet and then change values here and there and then dump it back in, if you like, whereas now you can write playbooks like in Ansible and do it that way, so define it in a different way. So sounds quite interesting. And they're talking about talking over SSH to the switches or using the, I think they've got some kind of API that Ansible can use to talk to them. It looked interesting anyway. Did a demonstration. On the rest of the day, saw some interesting talks, met loads of geeks, fellow sysadmins, and even some of the Ansible developers who've written this marvellous piece of software. So,
where was this, in London somewhere? Or?
Yeah, I was in London near the O2. I think it's the Intercontinental Hotel near the O2.
Okay.
Yeah, it's good fun.
Cool.
And free beer afterwards, which is always good.
What about you? Yeah, what about you, Andy?
I've had a few things I've been messing about with this week. One of these big houses that I've been to before, I've mentioned before. She had a few problems with the internet in there. And this is one of those surreal moments where it sort of took a little while for it to sink in a bit. One of the little rooms in there, which you'd probably call like the main hub for everything. I was looking for, because it was a big house, and I was looking for the router because it wasn't by the computer at all. And I went into this little cupboard, if you like, which had the router in. And I thought, oh, there it is, there. And I'm looking in there, and I'm thinking, I thought, there's something different about this place. And I couldn't quite figure out why it was different from the last time I went in there. And I just suddenly realised it's very spacious in this room. And I was thinking, there was something in here before. What was in here before and what's, you know, gone? And then it suddenly came to me that there used to be a big rack, which didn't have much in it, to be honest, a big cabinet with a rack in it with a patch panel in it. And there was a ProCurve switch in there. And I'm now looking at this floor where there's absolutely nothing. And I'm thinking, where's this ProCurve gone? So I call a woman down to say, you know, I was just in here looking for stuff. And I've realised there's things that are missing. And I said, there was a big box here. Yeah, one of those racks, the boxes that the rack goes in, cabinets, I should say. And she said, oh, yeah, we got rid of it. I said, why did you get rid of it? And she said that she'd had a TV man come in, and he said that we didn't need it anymore. So he said to her, do you want me to take out everything you don't need? And she said, yeah, do what you have to do. So he took the entire thing out. Everything. He took every single thing out. He'd all the cables from the back of the patch panel, he'd cut back. He'd actually shoved them in a hole in the wall as well. Everything had gone. The entire lot had gone. And I was stood there thinking, what the hell has this guy done? It wasn't exactly because he basically thought that none of this stuff was needed anymore. So we took it all out. This is a kind of problem I've had this week is, there's a difference, isn't there, between a TV engineer, a computer tech, a plumber, an electrician, right? We're all different, and we all do our own thing.
Yeah.
And as a profession, it's all right doing it for someone if you know them, but as a profession, you don't mess about with other stuff, do you? You don't say, oh, well, I'll put a new socket on the wall for you here, or I'll put a new radiator up for you, you know, when you're supposed to be there doing another thing. You don't mess about with other things. And it kind of got my back up at the time because I was thinking, why does he think that we don't have to do this? Why does he have to change everything round? An actual further investigation, he'd cut a load of Ethernet cables, went up into the loft as well from that old patch panel and switch. He'd cut the cables off up in the loft, put makeshift sort of sockets on it to connect all of his TV stuff up to. So he'd completely and utterly butchered this entire house in terms of Ethernet cables. So just to give an idea, it's a big house, but every single room in the house has about two or three Ethernet sockets in the wall that you can plug into anywhere in the house. They were all active and ready to go beforehand, and he's now completely and utterly took everything out, cut the cables back, took a ProCurve switch, took the entire cabinet, and everything was gone. And I said to the woman, I said, do you know who this guy is? Because can we get this stuff back again? I said, because this is not cheap stuff. I don't have to buy this stuff very often, but, you know, how much is a cabinet and a rack and a ProCurve and a patch panel and all the cables and everything like that? How much do you think all that would come to?
Is it a big full-size rack? It kind of attaches to the wall.
Yeah, it was on the floor. It always was on the floor, but it could attach to the wall. I suppose it's about... had a glass door on the front, you know. I'm trying to think of a measurement for it. 2 foot cubed, I suppose.
Yeah, I know the
you know the one
mean.
I mean? Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, how much would the one of them be?
Yeah.
Was it a half height rack or a full height rack?
Half height. Yeah.
Okay. Was it like a full server rack or just a comms cap? So you think about it, is you get.
I think it's one of those comms ones that
you can put on the wall. Or whatever.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So for a full size rack, you talk about £800, I think, for a full size rack.
So it wouldn't fit. It's just for a comms panel. You know, you could put several patch panels and several switches in there, and that's about it.
Had you done all the wiring, all the Ethernet stuff?
No, that had all been done previous to when she moved into the house. Yeah. So apparently the guy who lived there before was really into all this stuff. And he had it all wired. I mean, he had it done properly, you know.
Yeah.
You could tell he had it done properly.
So did they use a cabling then or not?
This is where I was trying to explain to her, because the guy before obviously did. Now, she didn't. But there is other things that are took into account. Like there's a CCTV camera system that was up in the loft.
Yeah.
He'd actually butchered the Ethernet cable to that, so the CCTV wouldn't work anymore because he'd basically cut it off completely.
Yeah.
Now there's no cable between the loft and this cupboard where this comms panel used to be because he'd cut it. And he's also using there are these little converters you can get in the I've been learning loads about TV, trying to fix all this up this week. Which basically go HDMI to Ethernet cable.
Yeah.
And it's a way you can get a HDMI signal from one end of the house to another using an Ethernet cable. That's what he's butchered it for, is in order to fit that in.
Right.
So it's basically it's not a case of they were using stuff all the time. But then I started to explain to her. I said, right. In one of the rooms, she wanted to do certain things. I can't remember what they are off the top of my head. I said, no, those things that you wanted to do in the future, well, you'd need that Ethernet socket on the wall to do that. But now you can't because it's completely and utterly wrecked. You know, there's probably a bunch of about 30 cables or something like that, which are chopped off and then shoved back in the wall again to keep them out of the way. I mean, I wouldn't say it's wrecked, but you're going to have to go through 30 cables and try and figure out which one you need.
Yeah, crimp them all again or repatch them.
So it's these things that she wanted to do in the future, which is now going to become a huge problem to do. But the point is, it was already there to begin with.
Yeah.
You know, everything was there, ready to go. You could literally, I'm trying to think of something simple, you know, you could literally just plug it in and you'd be connected. That's how it was, you know. Nice socket on the wall. It was a gold plated socket, you know, that kind of colored one. Plug it straight in, you connect it to Ethernet, and it would have been a case of just plug it in and it works. And now it's completely and utterly wrecked.
And a ProCurve switch as well. It sounds like it could well be like a managed switch, so you know, not cheap.
No. And I'm like, where is this stuff? Because A, this is not cheap stuff that's gone. And
possibly on eBay.
Yeah. And said, is it possible to get hold of this person and get this stuff back again? Because, you know, this is your stuff. This is stuff that you wanted to use in the future. That, you know, she's kind of ignorant to all the whole tech thing. She just said, the guy said to her, do you want me to take out everything you don't need? And she said, yes. And the point is, I suppose, he decided what she wanted to keep and what she didn't want to keep. Mm. You know, so the basic message is keep out of other people's work or keep out of other people's stuff, because I'm pretty sure he's a decent television engineer and he can, you know, set up multi-rooms in your house and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, sure, he's absolutely brilliant at that. But at the same time, he's not a network engineer and he doesn't know what cables go where, you know. So that was one. That was kind of like a shock horror kind of thing that I came across fairly recently. This is another good one. This is a different one altogether. Go to some other little company who had no internet at all. So I was checking. They had BT Business Broadband. I was checking the router. They seem to have a connection. It was a VDSL signal. They seem to have that okay. They were getting an IP address. And I was thinking, I can't find anything wrong with this. So I said to the guy that owns the company, I said, look, I said, we're going to have to check everything out as we possibly can at this end. I can't find anything wrong at this end. We're going to have to call BT up, tell them what the problem is, and see if, you know, the problem's at their end, because it might be at their end. So he phones them up, and he has to go through all the security questions. And then he stayed on the phone while they asked him a few more questions. And then he said, I just heard him say, oh, right, is that what the problem is? Oh, okay.
Don't tell me he hadn't paid the bill.
Correct. And he looked at me, then he put the phone down. And I thought, aren't you going to pass the phone to me so I can tell him what the problem is? He said, yeah. He said, apparently there's a bill overdue from last month. I went, ah, right. Luckily, then he said to me, oh, he said, okay, he said, sorry about that. He said, how much do I owe you? So I said, so he just sorted me a checkout straight away. So I thought, oh, well, no skin off my nose, I suppose. It's his problem. He's called me out. He's paid me. Yeah.
At least he paid you properly.
Yeah, yeah. So, he did straight away.
The check hasn't check my bounced yet. You know.
Yeah, he should have asked for cash.
Another thing I've been doing this week, this is just a bit of me messing about, is I've been learning a little bit about commands that you can use. I don't know if you can use them in PowerShell or just on the command prompt. So I've been learning about the SC command. I can't remember what it stands for now. But here's a script, here's a line that you could type out as an example. Sc config spooler start equals disabled. So basically, it's just the same as going into services, finding the print spooler. The actual service name is just called spooler. If you looked at that, yeah. And then you clicked. There's an automatic option, disabled, and manual option. And this is a way of doing it from the command prompt.
Yeah. So it stands for service controller. So you know, the services you can get, you can stop and start the print spooler. What you can also do if you've got an application.
Yeah.
And you want to run that, it running in the foreground. But if you want to say it's like an application on the server, you can do an SC command to configure that executable as a service so that you can make your own services, if you see what I mean.
Ah, right. Yeah, I was looking into how to make your own services. Yeah. Okay.
So I've had an interesting one this week. With account lockouts, one of our customers had a user account they used, but they couldn't work out what was locking it. They had a domain admin account. I always say you should really only have your own domain admin account, so you should always have two accounts. So the account you use on your local machine, which is what your local machine is, and then which has got your email and stuff attached to. But then you have a high privacy account for doing things when you are doing things. So you use that to log on to servers with and things like that. And one of our customers had a lockout where that kept getting locked out because he changed his password. And if you have a lockout, obviously, say if you've got something like a service running or something, it can lock out or something. Or if you've got some scheduled task running under that user account, or if you're logged into a machine, let's say your IDP machine, and then you disconnect from it, that account will still be... we're using your older credentials, and then obviously, do you see if you get if that then locks out? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So I didn't know about this, but one of my colleagues at work told me about it, and it's called network or NetWix, is that how you present it? NETWRIX, networks, NetWix. So it's like networks, but with an O and X at the end of it. Account Lookout Examiner is actually a free little product. And what that does is, because what you can do is actually, there's in the security log on your computer, you know, I've talked about before, the event various things in the past and app and the things like application logs and stuff. There's one there called security. And then there's things where everything gets logged. So you basically, you that's if someone does a false login or someone logs in, it records it in that event viewer. But the problem is because there's so many events in there and IDs and stuff, it's just really hard to read it. And this Account Lookout Examiner basically reads those logs and then displays it in a nice format, and it will tell you what PC that lookout's coming from, which is really handy. So you basically have to set up two group policies, which basically one what tells your domain controls to audit login failures, and another one what does audit logon failures on your PCs. So what the first logout does is it basically logs on the domain control. So obviously when you try and authenticate on the server, it will log where that failure came from. And then the second one is that it will log on the local machine what the logs on that machine what process kind of locked the account out, kind of thing. So what process made it? So what this does is that when it logs, you have to you install on your domain controller, and then you point it to the system log, and then it scans the security log all the time. And as soon as your account log out, it will basically pop up and say, this account's locked out, and this is the PC it's locked out on. You then click on examine. That then goes to the PC or the server which has got the account lockout, and it looks through that event viewer, and it will then tell you what the process is logging out. So it's really handy to log things out, and it will just basically tell you what the process is. Because like there's a number of things like what could be maybe looking at, like a map network drive, a task in a Windows task scheduler, like if you've scheduled a task run on this account in a Windows services running from a domain account. I tried all these things, no, but my one was that there's someone who stored something in the credential manager in the control panel. I never know about this, but you know, if you click on Windows, you like map a network drive on the serve to another PC, and you know that you can type in the box username and password. And you know, it's like a little box where you tick to say save password. Mm-hmm. That's where it saves it. It is in the credential manager in the control panel. So I went into the control panel, and there it was, his account. It's a good bit of software to look at in the future if anyone ever gets an account lookout.
Yeah, I didn't know it was saved in there. I don't go in there, to be honest, that much. But yeah, that's a good one.
So we wanted to talk about SPF records, weren't we, and DKMI.
That's correct. So, yeah.
So
who wants to go first?
These two, I'll do mine first because it probably makes sense. Then I can get going. So what you've got to So basically there's a background. So SPF stands for Sender Policy Framework. It's a simple email validation system designed to detect email spoofing. So the problem you've got with email is that it can be spoofed quite easily. So anyone can send an email, looks like where it was sent from anyone you desire. So someone can send an email and pretend to be Bill Gates, and if it looks like it was sent from bill.gates@microsoft.com, but if you reply to it, obviously send it back to the correct email address and not the spoof sender. Does that make sense, Andy? So you basically the problem with email is that anyone can spoof someone's email address, obviously, but if you reply to it, obviously it won't go back to them. But obviously, it's a bit of a security, like where we had before, where you said where someone can send an email that looks like it comes from internally, but it hasn't come internally, and think, oh yeah, I'm going to pay that bill because someone told me to.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
I mean, basically, that information, the from address and loads of other things, are held in the headers to the email. So it's kind of metadata that goes with the email message. So, and you can write whatever you want in there, basically. So that's a bit of a security risk.
It's always been like that, hasn't it? Hasn't it been like that for years? Because I even remember in pre-Outlook Express, you could do that probably.
I mean, email's been around for, 40-odd years? And it's kind of, it was designed like that and there's never been changed, really.
Yeah. So this is a way to kind of, it's not to prove who you, so it doesn't really help the sender, does it? So if it's me sending to Andy, it doesn't prove that I sent it.
No,
it doesn't.
What SPF does is it says that this server is allowed to send mail from this domain.
Yeah.
And you put that information in a DNS record. So presumably only you have control over what goes in that DNS record. So.
Yeah. So basically, you can, there's a function that says it's called SPF, which you can basically implement on your mail server or on your spam filter if you've got a spam filter before you do it. So, what it does is when your email server receives an email, it checks the DNS record of the sender domain in the email address you sent if it has an SPF record. So, basically, an SPF record is a text record. A text record is a type of DNS record which contains text. So, you know, like I talked about Emirates records before, CNAME records and AE records before. This is kind of a record where if you go to like abnabandpodcast.co.uk and you say, what's a text record of it? It basically pulls back. It will give you this text to probably prove it. So sometimes this can be validate your domain, i.e. So when you set up Office 365 and you want to prove that you own that domain, or if you're validating an SSL certificate, the company will normally would give you some text, which only what they and you know of, and they ask you to add that into your DNS record so that they can then query it to see if the value matches to what you've asked them to, and if it does, they confirm you own the domain. So that's basically just another a record. So SPF text record normally looks something like this. So it's normally like a text record. If you're in it in Linux kind of thing, it'd be in your bin.ny file. It would be something like your domain name space txt in capitals and space speech mark, then you go v equals fps1, which basically means you're running SPF version 1, and then you do a colon and you go the name of your mail server and then hyphen all. And what this record indicates is that only one server is allowed to send mail using the example domain. So I've basically got my one, mail.example.com. It's basically saying that the only people allowed to send mail is from example.mail.example.com. So we can only receive mail from mail.example.com. Now they know that, we just look at the IP address of the mail.example host, and then we just, if it matches what's in the FBF records, it's allowed to submit it. If the rest doesn't match the mail at the time of the call, it basically then gets on the next item. So you can have more than one things in there. So say if you've got like mail servers or a web server or something which sends mail on behalf of you, it doesn't let you, it will then go onto that list. So if it's got a hyphen all at the end, it'll basically say, nope, if you're not on the list, do not accept mail from anyone else. You can also have a tilde in there. Tilde means like a soft fail. So if you're testing it, it will do it. So like if you've got an example like in here, you can do things like, also you can do things called include. So like include.sbf.protection.outlook.com. So saying if your mail goes, like if you're using Office 365, obviously your mail looks like it's coming through Office 365, but obviously Office 365.com has got millions of IP addresses, and that basically just said anything from sbs.protection.outlook.com is allowed to send it. Or you can do things like IP4, and it will basically, you can put the IP address of the IP4. So, but again, obviously this only really works if everyone does FBS, kind of FPF records. I mean, I don't think I've got FPF records set up on my domain. So it also has problems. So you can set your email filter up so it says, like, if it doesn't accept it, if you haven't got FPF, don't accept it, kind of thing. Or I've had it in the past where people have had the wrong SPS records in there, because you can actually put, I was saying, a DNS TNX record, you can actually have an SPF record. This is now deappreciated, kind of thing. So it said, like, you've got an SPF record, get rid of this. We're not accepting mail until you've got it transferred into a TXT record, if that all makes sense.
Yeah. There's a website, spfwizard.net, which will generate you SPF records. So mm-hmm. if you ever need to know what to write in there, it's just got a number of fields and drop down boxes and things which will help you construct your SPF record. So that's worth looking at. Mm. Put a link in the show notes.
There's also a good website, the SPF Framework website, where I find information from it. It tells you, like, literally how to do it, kind of thing. So.
Yeah.
So yeah, it works, but it means everyone has to do it, kind of thing, if you know what I mean. So it's so you were talking about DKMI then now.
DKIM stands for Domain Keys Identified Mail, and what it does, it uses public private key cryptography to basically sign the message as it goes out. And then, so you've got one half of the key in the email signature, and the other half of the key in another TXT record. And I'm gonna actually, just so I don't confuse everyone, I'm gonna read this straight off Wikipedia. First, the message body is hashed, so it looks at what's in the message and makes a alphanumeric string out of that. Always from the beginning, possibly truncated at a given length. Second, selector header fields are hashed in the order given by H. So, if you look in the headers, there'll be a DKIM signature. The load of key value pairs, so like V equals 1, A equals RSA, SHA-256, D equals example.net, and so on. And then repeated field names are matched from the bottom of the header upwards, which is the order in which received fields are inserted in the header. A non-existing field matches the empty string, so that adding a field with that name will break the signature. What I said isn't quite right. It's using the key to generate hashes, basically. It refers to the TXT record. And what that means is that the data returned from the query is also a list of take value pairs. It includes the domain's public key along with other key usage tokens and flags. The receiver can then use this to decrypt the hash value in the header field and at the same time recalculate the hash value for the mail message, headers and body that was received. If the two values match, this cryptographically proves that the mail was signed by the indicated domain and has not been tampered with in transit. So it's using public-private key, which is used in things like SSH, SSL, to prove that the message, A, it came from who it said it did, and B, that it hasn't been changed while it was going from one mail server to another. So again, it uses DNS, which is something that you control on your domain. And it's something that runs on the mail server and it's kind of attached to the message as it goes out, and the mail server at the other end uses the same bit of software to check the signature, basically to check it's all valid. And hopefully that's a semi-clear explanation of how DKIM works. Does that make sense to everyone?
Kind of, yeah.
Maybe it wasn't too clear, but yeah, basically it uses public-private key cryptography to prove that the message came from who it said it did.
All right, okay.
And so it's mathematically, it's a mathematical certainty that the server that says it's sending the mail actually sent the mail.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So yeah, that's our quick overview of SPF and DKMI kind of thing. So yeah, I was going to say about we had an email in as well, haven't we, from someone? Did we? That from the guy we had last email in from.
Yes, we did. It was Tori, wasn't it?
Hmm.
I'll have to look it up. Has it come through to our email? Is it?
Yeah, I think so. That was quite worth it. I found another way. I've got another problem as well. I've got a problem where you heard anything called roaming profiles before, where it's like a thing in Windows where you, if you log onto multiple machines, you can have like a roaming profile, and you can kind of it log, so like the settings you got on your PC or whatever get saved to a profile. But if you're running on multiple PCs, you can basically log in to multiple PCs with that same profile. Like when you log onto the PC, you create your profile, and when you log off, it uploads your profile to the server. And then when you log onto a new PC, it downloads your profile from the server, and all your settings are the same. I've never had any much luck with them, because if you've got like millions of different versions of Windows and different hardware and different software on PCs, it can be really messing about on the.
Yeah, it can mess you about that, can't it? It's even things like you know, like printers or. What if you use a specific IP range or on the network card or default printers and things like that? It messes with all of that, doesn't it? So,
yeah. So we've got a problem where one of my customers, basically, when they log off sometimes, there's some of the software somewhere is corrupting the profile. So when they go log on to a new PC, they can't log on because their profile's corrupt. But, yeah, what happened then is that... We can't find out what's causing it, and the only way you can find out is working out what the PC they last logged onto. So I'll put this shit in the scroll notes. But with Greek policy, you can write a little script which basically, when it logs off and logs on, you can write to a text file on like a central server, and then it will basically write what PC and what PC they logged on and logged off on from, kind of thing. So I'll keep you an update on that, really. So for the future.
Cool. Yeah, I've been working on recently. Been looking at containers on my server. People have probably heard of Docker, and from looking at containers, it seems that on the sysadmin side, Docker's just really overcomplicating things. So I set up a container. Just a little test container with my SSH key and a Jerry user on there. And I've just been cloning that to make new containers. And this takes, you know, a couple of seconds to make a clone. Because all the container is, as I've sort of dug down into this, is a collection of files on your file system. And there's a bit of config to describe how it can be networked. So, I don't know if you've come across Al or Andy Chroot in Linux, chroot. But it's just a way of kind of going into a subdirectory on your file system. And then once you're in there, you can't see outside it. So that's basically what a container is, but it's got networking kind of built in. So on my new server, I'm using that to install this Sensu monitoring system. And it consists of three separate bits of software, which is the Sensu software itself, a message queuing system, which they the one they put in their docs is RabbitMQ. And what that basically does is it gets messages from things and then delivers them to something else. Something else can then read off that queue, and then in that case Sensu can put stuff on the queue to get sent out. So what happens with Sensu is all the clients, all the things that you're monitoring, write to this queue, and then Sensu gets the things one at a time, so it can process them. And then RabbitMQ also takes care of passing all these things out. So having all that separate and configuring all that's been taking quite a lot of my time. And the other thing is Redis. And Redis is, as I understand it, it just stores data, but it stores certain data sets in a certain way. But it's a really easy install. It's just installing the package. So, still not quite there. But once that's done, that's currently running my VPS, which is costing me a fortune. So the quicker I can get it done, the better. And then I can switch off that VPS or turn it into a much lower, much cheaper one. In my day job, I've been using more Terraform and Ansible, and feeling like I'm getting my head around it a lot more. I'm using Ansible at work for config management, which is something I put in myself, and I've worked out a way of getting the Ansible stuff to run when the node is built, because with AWS you find yourself rebuilding instances a lot of the time, like if a configuration changes, that often means using Terraform it rebuilds the whole thing, which is okay because all your data is in another service, either S3 or a database, which is basically untouched by rebuilding the server. So my main concern was getting Ansible stuff to run at build time, and I can also run the same code without having to rebuild the node. So yeah, that's what I'll be working on. I'm getting there. I'll probably put a blog post up about all of it, because it's a bit hard to go through on the podcast, I'd say.
I like that that rabbit thing, whatever it's called, MQ rabbit. That's quite a good system. I know a lot of people use it kind of thing. Have you done much with Amazon Route 53
before? Yeah, it's just a DNS, kind of DNS service, if you like.
But you can do things like latency-based routing, GeoDNS, and wait round robin, which is quite cool.
Okay, no, I haven't done anything with that yet. I've just really been using it like something like Zonomi or DNS Made Easy. All those services.
Cool. I want to get into it. I'd like to get into ZFS because that's really fun. Or the stuff you can do with that, the storage pools, everything. That's really interesting. Listening to different podcasts and stuff.
Yeah. I've been using ButterFS on my server. I was listening to the Linux Action Show actually the other day. He was quite disparaging about it. I've been using that with containers because when you're using ButterFS as a backing store for that. If you clone it, it basically creates what's called a sub volume.
Okay.
And that, what that does is it just takes the original and then takes the difference between the original and what you're working on. I think we talked about this before, copy on write. So it takes up a tiny amount of disk space to make that new container. So that's how I've been building my containers. And you can do all sorts of other things. I've got two disks in the server, and it's using ButterFS RAID 1. So it does RAID 1 and also does integrity checking as well. So
yeah, I want to make a new NAS. That's my next task. Is going to see. I really want to run it with it to the FS. I really like the idea of that kind of thing.
I was thinking of getting one of those HP microservers when I've got a bit of cash. I've got a little NAS, but it's just got a RAID on it at the moment.
My microserver is not very powerful. That's the problem, though. I'm running my email server on it now. When I'm running that on it, it's kind of like flat. It kind of So anything you want to do to their FS, it kind of powers out. The other thing is, I found another new podcast. I haven't listened to it yet. It's called Root Access. It's okay. It's called OpenDNS. The people who did DNSing in the launched Root Access as a podcast that looks like the most notable security stores and why they matter. So I'll put a show note in there. So okay.
I'm looking it up now.
We found the email, Jerry. Andy, even, sorry.
I have.
It's quite a long one.
It's quite a long one, so how long have we got left?
About 10 minutes.
I'll probably need 10 minutes. I haven't read it through entirely myself yet, but we can give it a go if you want. I'll take a deep breath and go for it. So this is from Brad. Brad Torrey, he's been on several Podnuts programs, and he's emailed us a few times in the show, which we greatly appreciate. But this was just up on a follow-up from a previous email we were talking about in the last show, and then we were discussing it. So he says, just followed up on the last email about my toolkit. You guys were talking about the cable toner I mentioned. It's a tool I picked up when I was doing some work on a phone system, but it comes in handy all the time when I'm working in the network that someone else set up where nothing is labeled. Ideally, when an office is wired for Cat 5 or Cat 6 or whatever, the wall plate is labeled and the wiring closet has a patch panel, and the other end of the cable is labeled with the corresponding number. Can I just stop that? That house that was asked, that has been talking about, that was all done in that particular place, just like that. And now it's all gone. So you knew where the cables go. I often find that the toner helps to find out the other end of the cable. And in this case, where there's no labelling done. Here in the States, at least, toners are available at home improvement stores, such as Home Depot, computer stores like Micro Center and Fry's, and of course, there's Amazon. And unlike Fluke network tools, they cost between $50 and $75. It's pretty cool. The sender end has an option of using clips that can connect to bare wires or an RJ14-style phone plug. You go to the wall jack, plug in the sending device, it sends some current through the wires like they are speaker wire. It's literally transmitting an audible tone through the wires, even though it's a phone plug. You can still use it for RJ45 network jacks that are just as compatible. The other half of the tool is a magnetic inductive wand. If you place the wand near the cable with the tone playing, it will pick up the signal and play the tone through the speaker. So you can go into a rat's nest in the wiring closet, wave it around next to the cables and starts playing a tone. And when it's placed directly in contact with the wire, the tone becomes perfectly clear and loud. You know you have the right wire. It helps out. That actually sounds really good.
Sounds like you might need it going forward in this house.
I probably will, yeah. in actual fact, I've got a very basic one, which just you plug one in one end, RJ45 on either end, and LEDs just light up on each particular cord just to tell you that it's okay or not. It sounds like a basic one of what he's got. So I'll carry on. So he says, he's got a funny story. I was tracing out a network where they had a little music player in the server room that played music throughout the office. It was after hours, so they had a speaker system turned off, but the music player was still on. I was toning cables and started to hear music playing very faintly through the little speaker on my toner wand. It's like a kid's game. It's like the kid's game of warmer and colder. You move it in one direction, the music gets louder, and move away from the source, it gets quieter. This particular job was getting a little frustrating, so this little moment of comedy was a nice distraction. I think the song was Lady Gaga's Disco Stick. So I got a laugh out of it. And of course, I had to turn the speaker player off so I could continue. A little tip on toners with wiring, with the network wiring. The tool is meant for phone cable, but Cat 6 twisted and shielded prevent electromagnetic interference, which makes it hard for the one to pick up the signal. Since the toner sends only an activating a single pair, you can boost the signal by making yourself a little jumper. I took a Keystone, the wall jack that you connect a Cat 5 cable to, and I connected a short bit of Cat 5 to it. I twisted the white and blue together with the white and green wires, and then twisted the solid blue together and the solid green wires. So now that the toner was sending its signal, it's much stronger signal. So if you can picture this, I can take a phone cord, plug it into the wall, and at the other end, I can plug in the phone cord into my little adapter, which I just made. Then I clip the toner to the twisted blue and green cables and go back to the server room, and the wires are much easier to find. Couple of words of caution, I don't usually tone out live network cables. I don't think the toner will damage a switch or a router, but it's sending a current down the line, so it's better safe than sorry, and disconnect everything. The other caution that is using the clips on the toner versus using actual phone plug presents a small risk of the clips touching each other and causing the short. The toner has a little surge protector in it to protect it, but you can damage a phone or something connected to the line, so be careful not to let the clips touch each other. It's not as complicated as it sounds. I mean, if a phone tech figures it out, then it can't be that hard. Just kidding. I have a couple of phone wiring friends, and we have some pretty friendly jabs back and forth, where I say phone guys and like the Andrathols. And they say network guys just make everything too complicated. Sorry for the long email, but it helps someone. But I hope it helps someone who is lost in a maze of wires one day. So that was a fantastic email.
Yeah.
From Brad. that's a good piece of kit, wasn't it? So we're basically on the right lines of it when we're talking about it last week. So what do you think of it now? Have you used it, or have any of you two got any stuff like that?
No, but it sounds like it's a handy thing to have in your bag.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Well, he's saying it's $50 to $75, so I suppose that's up to 50-odd quid for us. So that's not too bad, is it?
Yeah, a couple of things I was going to say. Actually, think about that. It's two things actually. I did try to replace that dish today at site because it was not hot pluggable. It had the server had to be shut down, and so annoyingly, the disc what came from HP wasn't in the caddy, and the caddy what came with. So basically, you take the disc, shut down the server, take the caddy out. So it's hot plug, it's pluggable, so you can press a button, it pops out like in the caddy. But you can't do it when the server's on; you have to shut it down. So you basically when you get the disc from HP, it's a disc, but it's got no caddy on it. So you have to take the screws off the caddy. But the problem I had was that the screws to get them off there were Torx screws, and this place where I had to go today was like was in the middle of the city, and I had the van with me, but it was like a couple minutes walk. So you know, before a couple of weeks ago, I was telling you that I was trying to get one of these messenger bags kind of thing. Mm. To organise my equipment with, but I didn't manage to get one. I actually found, going into our store cupboard at work, that they had some Belkin nice messenger bag, Stride 360, and I'll put links in the show notes to it. And it's a really good bag. It's like a normal, like a messenger laptop bag, but it's got like three pockets, or it's got like three or four pockets on the side of it, so that you can put. I'll put a link in this so you can have a look in the notes and so you guys can have a look. But it's really handy because it's got different pockets for different things. So there's like a pocket you can put the your power adapter in it, a pocket where I've got like little cables, and then you can put a pocket for my little thing, and I've got a pocket for my screwdrivers. And annoyingly, I didn't take a, well, I did take one in my backpack. I didn't take a Torx screwdriver to undo these screws to get them out of the caddy, which is annoying. But luckily in my brain, I went, I knew that I'd have this problem. So I took my, so I have a tool kit I keep in the van, which has got the more tools in it. So I need to look at a way of having a Torx kit really in my bag as well. Maybe it's just one size, just so that when I get to these situations when you need to replace a hard drive, you've got it, kind of thing. So
it's a constantly evolving thing, the bag of tricks, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. We like to be prepared. Like we had one engineer go to site, who basically had an ADSL port, but didn't bother taking a spare router or a spare analog phone. Well, no, he took a router, but he didn't take an analog phone. In the end, it actually had a dead line on it, so there'd actually be a T4. But if you took his phone with like an analog phone, you could have tested the line to make sure that it broke, if it failed or not, kind of thing. So yeah, I like to be prepared, kind of thing. So you kind of evolve anything. So next time I'll definitely make sure that I have a Torx in my bag. I need to find a nice little kit now to have in my bag. I was just looking on eBay now. Where you could have it'd be nice Torx screwdriver set, kind of thing. So yeah, anyway, that's me being prepared as a scout. So cool. Anything else to say, people?
I think that's it for me.
And one other thing I found tonight, do you know on Google Docs you can now use your microphone and type and speak everything out?
I did see that.
I was trying it before. It was absolutely spot on. Well, it was for me anyway.
I did no thanks in case it started taking down everything I said during the podcast.
I just try it. Open up a new document and try it.
Cool. All right, then. Well, I'm going to let everyone get on. Because we're recording on a different night. We normally on a Thursday, and I've got to get up and go to work in the morning.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
Okay, guys. I'll speak to you all soon.
Yep, see you soon. Bye now.
Bye.